What geostrategic ambitions are being achieved by the global war on terrorism triggered by the attacks on the World Trade Center towers 14 years ago? In what ways has the 9/11 truth movement been undermined in the time since the attacks? What do we know about the extremist Islamic terror groups and their links to U.S. and Israeli intelligence? Have there been any significant changes to the game plan of the U.S. and NATO powers which the 9/11 attacks helped to serve? With ISIS becoming the new official villain, is it possible that 9/11 is no longer needed to provoke the current military agenda? As we mark the 14th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, we get perspectives on the fallout from the event as it has established itself through the expansion of the U.S. and NATO military power. Providing us with their perspectives are last week's guest, FBI whistleblower and Boiling Frogs Post editor Sibel Edmonds, and Michelle Chosadovsky, Emeritus Professor of Economics, author, and founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization. On this week's program, the evolving war on terrorism, examining the post-9/11 military doctrine. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of September 11th, 2015. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Today, the 9/11 Consensus Panel releases two new consensus points, presenting evidence of official foreknowledge of the attacks. The first point deals with Able Danger, the codename for a high-level intelligence operation co-founded by Generals Hugh Shelton and Peter Schumacher, commanders-in-chief of the Defense Department's Special Operations Command, SOCOM. The second new consensus point shows that the attack on the Pentagon was expected in several quarters before the event. Several pre-9/11 military exercises involving planes flown into the Pentagon suggest that such an attack was not unexpected. That comes from the article, New Evidence of Foreknowledge of the 9/11 Attacks, from the 9/11 Consensus Panel, posted September 9th, originally appearing at consensus911.org. On the 18th of August, the U.S. aid recipients beheaded the 81-year-old Dr. Al-Assad for his refusal to reveal where many precious artifacts had been hidden, according to his son, who was kidnapped with him but released. The body was hung from one of the great Greco-Roman columns, his head placed between his feet. Many have written that Iraq and Syria's glorious archaeology survived even Genghis Khan's repeated assaults on the region, but not the U.S. and its terrorist beneficiaries. Genghis Khan, that's Supreme Khan of the Mongols, King of Kings, lived between 1162 and the 18th of August 1227. The 18th of August was when Dr. Al-Assad was so appallingly murdered nearly 800 years later. That comes from the article, The War on Syria and the Death of Civilization, The Assassination of Dr. Khaled Al-Assad, Guardian of Palmyra, by Felicity Arbuthnot, posted September 9th. It's no secret that Syria's government is a major arms, oil and gas, and weapons ally of Iran and Lebanon's resistance political group Hezbollah. This coalition and meddling in Syria came about immediately on the heels of discussions of an Iran-Iraq-Syria gas pipeline that was to be built between 2014 and 2016 from Iran's giant South Pars field through Iraq and Syria. With a possible extension to Lebanon, it would eventually reach Europe, the target export market. Indeed, tensions were building between Russia, the U.S., and the European Union amid concerns that the European gas market would be held hostage to Russian gas giant Gazprom. The proposed Iran-Iraq-Syria gas pipeline would be essential to diversifying Europe's energy supplies away from Russia. That comes from the article, Migrant Crisis Fueled by Gas Pipelines, by Minar Muhawesh, posted September 10th, originally appearing at Mint Press News. In spite of Habyarimana's peace efforts, violence escalated to such an extent after his assassination that Rwanda went from being viewed as a potential success story in the early 1980s to an unsolvable basket case in 1994. That year, the international community deemed the situation in Rwanda so unmanageable that it pushed, quote, for the complete removal of UN troops because it didn't want UN troops to stand in the way of Kagame's conquest of the country, even though Rwandan Hutu authorities were urging the dispatch of more UN troops, unquote. The UN, which had been inactive during the genocide, was afterwards forced to uphold victor's justice to justify the socio-political and financial chaos it had created in the region. Therefore, it created the ICTR and tasked it with upholding the Hutu extremist narrative at all costs through the common law system. Later on, this assignment also required suppressing all future evidence pointing to the RPF's complicity in Habyarimana's assassination. That comes from the article, Who Was Behind the Rwandan Genocide? Debunking the Hutu Extremist Myth. Why the ICTR Refuses to Examine the Assassination That Triggered the Rwandan Genocide, by Guillaume Cress, posted September 9th. If real investigative journalism was still alive and kicking in our corporatized, for-profit media environment, and if exposing big lies was still regarded as important in our dying democracy, the blacklisting of 9/11 truth seekers and the court of law-worthy evidence that they have collected would have been celebrated and not denigrated. But the absurd, official, media-blessed version of what happened on 9/11/2001 has proven to be totally false, and the consequences of the failure of our leaders to admit that they have been bamboozled by the big lie have been devastating to the world. The consequences of the illegal and fraudulent invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq, orchestrated under the guise of several big lies by the Cheney-Bush administration, are still being played out in the millions of war refugees in the region that are desperately trying to leave the war-torn nations that the Pentagon helped to destabilize. The endless wars that began in earnest after 9/11 and the Constitution-shredding Patriot Acts and Homeland Security Act had all been planned long before the Three Towers came down, and the recurring wars of retaliation, Saddam tried to kill my daddy, G.W. Bush, and resource theft, oil equals Operation Iraq Liberation, had likewise been planned ahead of time. Critics of American imperialism totally understand that great Satans make good use of big lies. That comes from the article, 9/11 Truth, Debunking the Neocon 9/11 Narrative, The Workings of Big Lie Propaganda, by Dr. Gary G. Coles, posted September 10th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. It has been 14 years since the attacks on the World Trade Center towers shocked the world and drove forward a so-called war on terrorism. The war has claimed hundreds of thousands of lives in conflicts ranging from Afghanistan to Iraq to Libya, Palestine, and Ukraine. Legislation embraced by Western countries, from the U.S. Patriot Act to Canada's Bill C-51, have led to the restriction of civil liberties. Tremendous levels of spending have been redirected away from programs of social uplift toward the military, and particularly the various technology and other firms that profit from war. A stubborn 9/11 truth movement arose as revelations of problems with the official story have come to life. Among the more robust is the group Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, which now names over 2,300 professionals with credentials in the fields of architecture or engineering, who are on record as doubting the explanation of how the Twin Towers collapsed. On this week's program, we examine the fallout from 9/11 with a particular emphasis on the wars and aggression spawned in its wake. Sibel Edmonds is the editor of the Boiling Frogs Post and founder-director of the U.S.-based National Security Whistleblowers Coalition. She is the recipient of the 2006 Penn Newman's Own First Amendment Award and the author of two books, including her memoir, Classified Woman, The Sibel Edmonds Story, a memoir, and a work of fiction, The Lone Gladio. She was recently interviewed by Global Research NewsHour contributor Jonathan Wilson. Here she is reflecting on 9/11 and its legacy.
Just because it's the 14th anniversary of 9/11, and you know, there was a lot of information coming out in the years following, and then there was the official report. You testified at the 9/11 Commission, and as far as I know, nothing that you said made it into the report, right? It was all classified and
sure, they put a footnote
away.
Saying that they interviewed me and got the documents, information. However, they were all covered by the state secrets privilege and classification. So I made it to this footnote, or at least the information I provided became a footnote. That was there, but that was not going to be published.
Right. So now looking back, like what is your opinion about, what took place? I mean, you know, we could see who benefited, but it's, it's still something that people wonder about, and that kind of opinion and idea that, inside forces were involved. It's very prevalent still, but it seems like the media will never touch it. What do you think of, kind of the general idea of what was behind that?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, again, that's both based on my short tenure with the FBI, subsequent events that followed it. The sources and people I have gotten to know from various fields relevant to what happened in 9/11, the fact remains that it was a major false flag operation. Now, I could never I can never offer any kind of details saying, okay, so let's talk about Mohammed Atta, But again, there's so much research out there with facts, documented facts on these actors. Who supposedly carried out this major terror event, synthetic terror event, and the fact that they were going to, they needed to have this event, this terror event in the United States, and they conceived the idea. They even publicized it in 2000, a year before 9/11. I mean, there's this document called PNAC, P-N-A-C, the Project for New American Century,
right, yeah.
With the signatories, and some of those signatories, they were the names under the files that I told you about, this special counterintelligence operations. You know, you're looking at people like Douglas Feith, you're looking at Richard Pearl, you're looking at Wolfowitz. They actually spelled it out, and they said, this is a chance. We're at this crossroad as a nation, with the fall of the Soviet Union, to become the singular, one and only global superpower. And there's so much that needs to be done. We need to take over the Middle East, Eurasia, which ends up being Central Asia / Caucasus, and that we need to do this. This is the obligation of U.S. to establish itself once and for all as a superpower, period. However, to do this, the United States needs the backing of public, and for that to happen, it just doesn't seem likely. Think about it. For 50 years, we milked this notion of communism and the big, bad, scary Soviet Union with their nuclear powers, and by doing so, justified spending trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars on military-industrial complex and the intelligence-industrial complex, and opening and putting in place all these bases, military bases, all over Europe, you know, and in, including in South Korea, in Asia. Well, with the Soviet Union dissolving, the public here, people in the United States started saying, great, now that we don't have this big, bad, ferocious, scary enemy, let's do things for our country, you know, whether it's for our own poverty, for our education, for transportation, for infrastructure, for welfare, for all these kinds of things that we have been lacking because we have to put all these resources and make all these people rich within the military-industrial complex. Mm. And so basically, PNAC's designers, authors, they were saying, people are not going to accept that. We can't just go and starting this dominance goal and implementing it with the Soviet Union gone. However, the only way for us to achieve this objective of permanent absolute dominance hinges upon a major catastrophic terror event here in our country, in the United States, on our soil. Because if we had such an event, and this is for people who are not familiar with PNAC, because I'm sure many of your readers, knowing global research being one of those very, very few real alternative sites with wealth of information, so many of your listeners are going to say, oh, God, don't I know all about it. But just in case there are people who have not looked into PNAC, they said, and this is simplifying it, they said, we need this event. And the event has to be like Pearl Harbor. It has to be in the United States, and it has to be big. They put this, they sign it, it's out there, it's a public document, mm-hmm. and lo and behold, a year later, that exact event that they wanted takes place. Now, if you are one of those highly skeptical people saying, you know, there are coincidences in life, then you have to then pause and say, okay, what followed that terror event? One by one, going through the objectives and the goals listed, the other objectives outside the big terror event in the United States, and PNAC saying, you know, with Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran, you know, places like Libya, what we have been doing with candidacy of Georgia, making Azerbaijan a NATO member. I mean, with the Soviet Union gone, think about it. NATO should have been dissolved, right? Why would you have NATO? NATO was established as a counter to communist Soviet Union's military power in the region, in Europe. It's the North Atlantic organization. Its sole purpose of existence supposedly was that. Mm-hmm. Now, with the Soviet Union gone, I mean, you were looking at having this organization, useless organization, dissolved, right? Not only we did not dissolve it, we ended up expanding NATO. One by one, first chopping some of these Eastern Bloc nations, getting three nations out of one, no longer having Bulgaristan or Czechoslovakia or et cetera, but putting bases, military bases in Poland, the NATO bases, then start moving towards Central Asia Caucasus, putting a NATO base in Azerbaijan, inviting Georgia to become candidate. Well, that was made possible. This was the vision. This is the goal of PNAC. That started taking place as a result of 9/11. Attacking Iraq, which was an objective, was accomplished right after 9/11. So not only that the event took place, one by one, we started doing what was spelled out in that document. So when you get this, and this is the simplified version, and you put together with all the leaks, all the whistleblowers, all the documents that have been made available to the public, granted, not via mainstream media, it is not something that can be considered crazy, nutcase, conspiracy, far-fetched kind of a theory.
Right.
You're looking at, it is far more substantial as a fact than any other fable, fantasy, stories that have been fed to the public to date, whether some box cutters doing that and Al-Qaeda or what they are selling today as ISIS. So I guess that would be what I would add or present as 9/11 to date. And I have to also say that it's hard not to be pessimistic because the vigorous movement started dying down,
yeah.
and now we don't see it as much, which was the intention to start with, to begin with. And I have to also give credit to the establishment, to the deep state and its mainstream media by coming up with really innovative, creative ways to kill the movement. I mean, we had so many false pretend agents put out there as 9/11 activists or groups that discredited the movement tremendously. It hurt the movement tremendously. And now many people have started looking at it as another fringe minority group, such as the Kennedy assassination, researchers. You know, how many years has passed since Kennedy's assassination, and still nobody knows what happened, you know, the real facts. And 14 years since 9/11, and are we heading towards the same kind of situation, the same kind of a direction? I certainly hope that we are not.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. After writing this book, writing The Lone Gladio, testifying, giving interviews, many other honorable whistleblowers, researchers who have done tremendous amount of work, seeing the public's response, or more accurately, lack of response, is frankly discouraging, and it's hard not to become pessimistic.
For sure. And I wanted to, I don't know if you have a, you know, much of an opinion on this, but what do you think of the, you know, one of the groups that's still pushing, trying to get 9/11 information out there is the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, and the theory that the Twin Towers and Building 7 fell because of planted explosives. What is your opinion of that, like the idea that happened?
Well, it's very hard for me to form an opinion because one of the things I have done, with everything I have said, everything I have written, I have made sure that I would stay within the facts that I know of, that I can support and I can back up, back, mm-hmm. And not engage in any speculation, and not having expertise in that area. It would be foolish for me to say, well, yeah, I can see that because, you know, the left brain, right brain thing, politically, geostrategically, I can with confidence talk about what's going on in the region or Operation Gladio, Turkey, Middle East, because that is my background. It is within my field of study. But I have never, ever had gained any knowledge or information from anything that is related in any way to engineering. It makes me pause. I would not dismiss it whatsoever because when you have hundreds of engineers, architects, and these are experts, come together, study, research, look at it, collectively come and put forth their theory or what they believe it happened, you can't dismiss that. I mean, unless none of them have the degrees, mm-hmm. How could you just go ahead and dismiss and say, oh, well, that's crazy. But on the other hand, because I haven't spent much time studying the issue and I don't have any expertise in the engineering or architecture field, I won't be able to make a case for it or against it. All I would say is I pause and I always listen, and dismissing it would be foolish because, as I said, you won't dismiss if you have 500 doctors. Forget 500. If you have 50 licensed practitioner doctors come and say certain things, let's say about vaccination, would I dismiss that? I don't think so. I will never dismiss such a thing. In fact, I would say, and it does happen. Unfortunately, we don't get the numbers. I don't want to get outside the topic of vaccination,
mm-hmm.
but any of these doctors who have come forward challenging a lot of studies and research and talk about the negative aspects of certain vaccinations, they have been pushed out of the industry by the pharmaceutical giant corporations, mega corporations, of course, the lobby and such. The same thing goes for these groups of architects and engineers. I would not dismiss it, but I can't add or I cannot informedly, intelligently engage in any discussion not having that expertise.
Well, that's pretty much all the time we have. Really appreciate this interview, Sibel. And is there anything else you wanted to add or maybe say just about, you know, the 14 years later and the fact that, you know, it's 14 years pretty much since you you went through, you know, what happened at the FBI and have been pushing this information since. Like, what would you say about, you know, this journey that you've been through in the past 14 years?
Yeah, that's always the hardest question because, you know, what happened was initially, and I'll do this fairly speedily, sure. I was really blaming the political system. I was at the beginning of this journey when I went to Congress and they were shut down by the Justice Department and the CIA because they actually placed an official gag via retroclassification on U.S. Congress, which is completely against anything that is in Constitution. It was if Congress, I kept saying, if Congress were doing what it's supposed to be doing, instead of these, you know, sold-out, awful, corrupt politicians, we wouldn't be in this position. Then when I went through the court system, it was, my goodness, and you get to see these judges and federal courts, and you see that when it comes, when you're going against the government, federal government itself, and these are federal courts, you are not dealing with an independent, separate entity. And I kept saying, had they been doing, or if they were doing what they are supposed to be doing, you know, serving the public, the truth, the justice. So I went through this whole thing by pointing, saying how wrong these parts of, I mean, the whole Congress and the court system, and you see how corrupt it is. Then, of course, came the time when I saw the mainstream media, whether they were censoring or blacking out or twisting or printing just plain lies, and the systems, governments, deep states, marketing firms pointing finger at them. After all these years, after I would say around 2009, 2010, I came to this realization, my own realization, whether right or wrong, that a lot of it actually boils down to we the people. And a lot of the blame actually lies with the people in this thing that, yes, the apathy, sure, a lot of it is system created, whether it's through our education system and our mainstream media and the movies, etc. But people can't shrug that responsibility and saying, well, I'm so busy with work and or this is the only thing that was available to me, because we see others who are countering that and overcoming that. So I would say my biggest disappointment has been with people, has been with the level of apathy. And as long as we have that, the optimism to overcome and to change things, the hope for it dims. And that's why informing the public and having trying to counter those forces, whether it's the education system or the mainstream media, it's a must. And with that, I have to say that global research has been doing that, because I discovered global research about, I would believe, around 2011, 2012, and I have a list of sites that I put under my favorites. So every morning I go through those websites to read truly alternative editorials and news pieces. Well, global research has been there, and it gives me hope, you know. And I can count, maybe not using both hands, the number of true alternative medias. I distinguish between pseudo-alternatives, the ones who are backed by the exact same establishment that backs the mainstream media, either it's the Soros Foundation or the Carnegie, or you're looking at the, you know, the Koch brothers. I would say the ones I believe in, they are less than 10, and global research is one of them. So I think, and I believe, you have been doing great work, all of these people who contribute, authors, the journalists, the videos you put out there. So while things are making me pessimistic, especially public, the apathy, there are things that give me optimism, and one of them is seeing that at least they exist. The number is not there. The alternative alternative media sources, outlets, but at least it's there. And that is a cause to, I guess, hope and celebrate.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. It has been 14 years since the U.S. and its NATO partners responded to the 9/11 attacks with a determination to wage a global war on terrorism, the notion being that there were radical groups mostly centered in Islamic countries determined to wage aggression on so-called free countries in the West. It has been the editorial position of the Global Research website and this radio program that the war on terrorism, so-called, is mostly a front for waging aggression to secure the ambitions of imperialist countries and their regional partners, which are not necessarily connected with security or the spread of democracy. With nearly a generation separating America's Pearl Harbor from today's international scene, we take a moment to reflect on the role of 9/11 in galvanizing current military activities. Has the war that former Vice President Dick Cheney said will not end in our lifetimes evolved or altered course in any fundamental way? Joining us to discuss the post-9/11 military doctrine is Michel Chossudovsky. Michel Chossudovsky is Professor Emeritus of Economics at the University of Ottawa. He's founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization in Montreal. He's the editor of Global Research and the award-winning author of 11 books, including America's War on Terrorism, Towards a World War III Scenario, The Dangers of Nuclear War, and his most recent, The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity. So thank you very much for joining us, Professor Chossudovsky. Going back briefly to the attacks themselves, do you want to maybe name a couple of points that convince you that this was essentially fabricated?
My first reaction was to say, well, assuming that Al-Qaeda is behind these attacks, and knowing the history of Al-Qaeda going back to the Soviet-Afghan War, then I would say that the CIA, as the state sponsor of Al-Qaeda, was behind these attacks. That was my initial reaction, namely the relationship between Al-Qaeda and U.S. intelligence going back to the Soviet-Afghan War, late 70s, early 80s, suggested that Al-Qaeda, being a U.S.-sponsored intelligence asset, and if this U.S.-sponsored intelligence asset it was involved in a terrorist act, then the sponsors are also involved in the terrorist act. Now, in the course of those 3 weeks separating the 11th of September to the 7th of October, some very important things occurred which have a bearing on the whole doctrine of the global war on terrorism. First of all, Afghanistan, through diplomatic channels, the Afghan government, contacted the U.S. State Department and said, if you have credible evidence that Osama bin Laden was, preliminary evidence that Osama bin Laden was behind these attacks, we will gladly deliver him to the U.S. justice system. Now, that was transmitted through diplomatic channels, and President George W. Bush reacted to this invitation by the Afghani government and said, we don't negotiate with terrorists. And that was the end of it. There was a subsequent diplomatic memorandum which was set repeating this offer to deliver Osama bin Laden to the United States justice system. And there was, of course, no follow-up. And then on October the 7th, the war on Afghanistan broke out, and anybody who has a minimal understanding of military planning knows that you don't prepare a theater war of that magnitude in a matter of 3 weeks, which signifies that the war on Afghanistan was already in the pipeline It was on the drawing board of the Pentagon well before 9/11, and that 9/11, the 9/11 attacks, was ultimately the pretext and the justification for waging that war. Now, that war then led to subsequent wars, and the narrative was very similar. The military doctrine, which then became embedded in Pentagon manuals, is that we have to wage a war against the terrorists, irrespective of the so-called collateral damage that this might cause to independent sovereign countries. And then if we look at the history of that, of those 14 years, we have a sequence of military operations which are part of a roadmap. And certainly Cheney indicates the existence of this roadmap, and so does the Pentagon when they talk about the Long War. The Long War is a Pentagon concept, but that Long War is a humanitarian war, and the humanitarian war is under the auspices of going after terrorists with a view to protecting civilians and so on. So that 9/11 is the building block of the global war on terrorism. It is the building block of U.S. foreign policy, and that's why 9/11 truth is the greatest obstacle to U.S. Aspirations with regard to conquering the world, extending economic frontiers, and so on, because without 9/11, their whole justification for waging humanitarian wars collapses like a deck of cards.
Okay, let's talk about that game plan for a moment. Do we know what that game plan is? And has that game plan been in place all along, or did that 9/11 turning point, was the main point of 9/11 just to galvanize support for this pre-existing war plan, or did it, has anything changed since then about like where they go and what countries they destabilize and so forth?
Well, the game plan since the Soviet-Afghan war has been to train terrorists, to recruit them, and to finance them. And this happened in country after country. In the wake of the Afghan war, you had Bosnia-Herzegovina. And essentially, the United States was funding al-Qaeda. And the Al-Qaeda was integrated into the Bosnian Muslim army. Then you had Kosovo, and you had Al-Qaeda operatives in Kosovo, which were collaborating with the Kosovo Liberation Army. And so these were insurgents which were supported and funded by the Western Military Alliance. In some cases, that funding was overt. In the case of the KLA, well, they funded the KLA. This was a patriotic movement. They didn't look at the fact that actually Al Qaeda was linked to the KLA and also involved in training operations. And so, what has happened is that in all of these wars, the United States has used these al-Qaeda-affiliated entities as their foot soldiers. So that, in a sense, we're in a very sort of, ambivalent sort of duality. On the one hand, the U.S. says we're going after the bad guys, the terrorists, but then, as far as covert operations are concerned, what they're doing is that they're actually recruiting these bad guys, mercenaries. They have a large-scale process of recruitment, always, of course, entrusting their allies, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, to do the dirty work. But in effect, I recall when I started doing research on Syria, that in the spring of 2011, it was confirmed, and it was confirmed by Israeli intelligence sources, that NATO and the U.S. and the Turkish High Command were involved in recruiting Mujahideen to fight the war in Syria, and the various factions within Syria, whether it's al-Nusra or the Islamic State and various others, they're all supported covertly by the Western military alliance, with certain allies playing central roles such as Saudi Arabia and Turkey. There's a sense of there's a sense of denial in that regard. And one's understanding of the war in Syria, which is presented to the broader public, is that Bashar al-Assad is a dictator. He's killing his own people with chemical weapons. He's destroying the whole country, destroying factories, schools, hospitals, and so on and so forth, when in fact, much of this destruction comes from U.S., NATO, Israeli-sponsored so-called jihadists trained in Saudi Arabia and Qatar, financed with weapons provided by Western military advisors, training in chemical weapons, which was even confirmed by CNN reports. And then what happens is that these people at the beginning of the war in Syria, they were labeled freedom fighters. Okay, they were part of the so-called opposition, so that in effect all the atrocities committed were blamed on Bashar al-Assad, when they were in fact committed by terrorists, which were financed by the Western military alliance. Mm-hmm. And as things progressed, the justifications started to shift, to the extent that since last August, the United States has now joined the war on terrorism within Syria by air raids, which are allegedly targeting the terrorists, but in fact, all the reports confirm that they're not targeting the terrorists. I mean, the terrorists could have been eliminated. They were there with their Toyota trucks crossing the desert. It would have been a clinical operation, surgical bombing, and in a few hours they would have eliminated them. No, they're protecting them. And that war on terrorism launched in August of last year, that means routine bombings of a sovereign country. They're not there to liberate anybody, or they're not there to go after the terrorists. They're there to bomb a country into and transform that country into a territory. And then what we have is, this creates a refugee crisis. It destroys a national identity, not to mention the bombing of historical monuments and buildings such as Palmyra. And all this is done under the auspices of a humanitarian mandate of protecting civilians against terrorists, when in fact most of the people who are being killed are not the terrorists, but they're civilians.
Professor Chostovsky, I'm wondering if, like, the game plan, like, did we know way back, did the neocon, the planners know, but way back in 1990 or whenever, that we're going to go into Syria in 15 years' time, we're going to go into Ukraine after that? I mean, or are these things that they kind of came up with as they went along, maybe in an ad hoc kind of way?
I would suspect, but from what I've read and the statements made, is that we're talking about a roadmap of military operations. The project for the new American century says actually that what is envisaged is the implementation of simultaneous theater wars in different parts of the world. Some of them, of course, are consecutive, but we now see In fact, the United States deployed major regions of the world, and in terms of military deployment, regime change, colored, so on. So that, yes, I don't think, knowing how military planning is conducted, none of this, this is not a piecemeal operation.
Okay.
It is a carefully planned roadmap. And the thing is that when you look at the military actors, let's say Israel or NATO, Saudi Arabia, it's all coordinated. There's an integration of air defense systems. The allies work in very close contact with the Pentagon and NATO. And there is the plans, let's say, to invade Iraq. They go back to the 90s. The plans to invade Iraq and Iran go back to the 90s, according to U.S. documents. And I would say that active plans to bomb Iran have been on the drawing board of the Pentagon for at least 10 years. And so we're dealing with a formidable force, with all the logistics and high tech of communications, weapon systems, and that's where we are. We're not in the previous dogma was anti-communism during the Cold War era, and then there was a transition period, but people believe in the war on terrorism. They believe in 9/11. And at the same time, politicians in high office are in a very difficult situation, because if this belief starts to shake somewhat or is no longer as strong as what they'd like it to be, well, then the whole thing collapses like a deck of cards. They need the narrative. They need the propaganda. And that's going to be very important on 9/11, of course. They'll have to commemorate. They'll have to say we have the bad guys, ISIS, Osama bin Laden. And the irony is that the falsehood is that just about a week ago, General Porteous, who was former CIA boss and as well as Central Command General at one point in his career, recommended and to the U.S. government, to the Obama government, to use al-Qaeda against ISIS. And that seems to be the new normal. So we support the al-Qaeda, the moderate al-Qaeda, against ISIS, who are the bad guys. But how can you do that when al-Qaeda was responsible for 9/11? Are we saying now that the presumed architects of 9/11, I'm not saying that they were, but the presumed architects of 9/11, according to the official narrative, are now allies of the United States against the bad guys who are the ISIS? It becomes totally absurd when, in fact, ISIS and al-Qaeda is the same thing as al-Qaeda against al-Qaeda. And so to make us believe all this nonsense, they need more than simply media disinformation. They need a kind of conditioning of people's mindset that you can't go against the American Inquisition.
Okay? I have another. I want to, because we only have a few minutes left. But the whole idea that 9/11 has also enabled a change in the international. These international institutions, certain restrictions on the kind of behavior that these nations can conduct. I mean, they invoked NATO Chapter 5 to go after terrorists when they haven't even determined that these terrorists were weren't directed by Afghanistan, as you pointed out, but somehow that loosened it up. It's also changed the kinds of doctrines, like the nuclear doctrine. It opened up the opportunity to use more powerful weapons, which they couldn't do before, did it not?
Well, the nuclear issue is a case in point, because shortly after 9/11, the Pentagon redefined its nuclear doctrine in relation to what it was during the Cold War era, that it was the doctrine of mutually assured destruction. You don't use it, because if you use it, your adversary will also use it, and this will destroy the whole world. That was understood. But now what they're saying is that there's a new generation of nuclear bombs, and we need those nuclear bombs to go after terrorists and regimes like Saddam Hussein. And they're called the small nuclear bombs. And then they come up with the notion that these nuclear bombs, which have an explosive capacity of 1/3 to 6 times the Hiroshima bomb, are harmless to the surrounding civilian population because the explosion is underground, I quote, unquote, and therefore we can use them. And then they also say we can use these to go after Al-Qaeda. And then subsequently in the discourse they say we have to be very careful of the possession of nuclear weapons by non-state actors, intimating that the jihadists could also develop their nuclear bombs and could use them against the free world, so to speak, or the Western world, so that now there's been a big surge in attempting to prevent Al-Qaeda from getting nuclear weapons, when, of course, the whole thing is ridiculous because Al-Qaeda is an intelligence asset. But that's used as a means, essentially, for the United States to establish some kind of monopoly of nuclear warheads, which could be used, of course, but they now are contemplating the use of nuclear weapons in the conventional war theater, and there's nothing that prevents them from doing it. The Senate has given the green light, and it is no longer a matter for the commander-in-chief, namely the President of the United States, to give that green light. It can be taken at the level, let's say, of Central Command. So we're in a very dangerous crossroads in our history, because the dogma and the propaganda don't even allow you to understand the logic, the geopolitics behind all this, and the ultimate objective, which is the neoconservative objective of worldwide economic conquest, which is supported by the global war on terrorism.
I have one more question I'd like to direct to you, and it regards the whole 9/11 legend. I mean, you said earlier you destroy the lie of 9/11 and the edifice of the war on terrorism falls down like a deck of cards. But we're hearing now that the new enemy is ISIS, and that Al-Qaeda, as you were just saying, is now somehow the allies of ISIS. I don't hear anyone saying that ISIS was responsible for 9/11. So I'm wondering if the 9/11 legend is still needed to support the current war agenda. If 9/11 legend hasn't somehow worn out its welcome, and that even you could see that ISIS, I mean, people who aren't really well informed might see ISIS as blowback from the so-called bogus war on terrorism. I mean, I know somebody who believes that the Twin Towers are brought down by controlled demolition, but he still hesitantly is a supporter of the war on ISIS. Is that something you think you could address?
Well, the whole thing becomes absurd because
I know, but
nobody remembers the fact that ISIS was in fact Al-Qaeda in Iraq. That was its original acronym, and it is an Al-Qaeda entity, and consequently, from the propaganda point of view, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, or ISIS, which was renamed, should constitute the same threat as the other Al-Qaedas. But you're right in saying that the fact that ISIS is no longer ISIS has now got a new identity, which is distinct from Al-Qaeda. Bin Laden is presumably dead, so that they're building, as they proceed, they're building new narratives to justify military action, which are not necessarily hinging on the 9/11 attacks. The 9/11 attacks is landmark because it really is the launch pad of the global war on terrorism. But now you call these, you change the names, and then you might at one point have Russian terrorists, you know, because, of course, the U.S. Is also targeting Russia and also targeting China, so that they have to create an enemy, and they have to create the image of an enemy, and that image is there, and people see it, and they see it in Hollywood, and of course the justification of which is provided by 9/11 may in fact fade, precisely because 9/11 truth is coming to a point where where a lot of contradictions are being revealed. But I should mention another thing. The 9/11 truth movement is not a homogeneous movement by any means, and some of these broader geopolitical implications are not well understood, so that they look at it from a purely domestic point of view. I mean, they've done fabulous work, but the broader implications are that 9/11 was the justification for waging war. There were other objectives. There were financial objectives, and so on. But the key element in 9/11 is to justify the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, and so that we have a sort of impetus to this long war, which the Pentagon describes essentially as a timeline, as a roadmap. And we recall the famous statement of General Wesley Clark when he said, when he confirmed from Pentagon sources that they were going to implement five countries in a list of seven, I don't recall correctly, would be the object of U.S. military interventions over a certain number of years. And that is certainly the case. If we look at the Middle East and Central Asia today, we have, how many countries do we have at war, which are part now of the regional war? Pakistan, the drone war, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and then we have Yemen. Okay? Then we have a situation then we have Libya, 2011. Then we have the Arab Spring in other countries, regime change. Then we have actions by NATO and the U.S. military in Eastern Europe on Russia's doorstep. Then we have the pivot to Asia, which is threatening China. So, and if we look further south to sub-Saharan Africa, we have a number of wars which are presented as civil wars, but in most cases, they are covertly supported by foreign powers.
Professor Chostovsky, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but I want to thank you very much for sharing that analysis with us on this rather critical anniversary. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And we've been speaking with Professor Michel Chostovsky, founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization and the award-winning author of several books, including his most recent, The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. Many thanks to this week's guest interviewer, John Wilson. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.